We're going to cover the news of the week. And yeah, again, we appreciate you tuning in, and let's go ahead and begin. So first of all, ADCs are still in the news. This train will not let up. And we saw an acquisition this week and some other notable news in the ADC space. So Yaron, I'm going to ask you to kick this off for us.
So Chris, Yaron just texts. Oh, there he's back. Okay, never mind.
Yeah. So did you guys hear me open up on the ADCs?
Yeah, Yaron might be having issues with his sound.
Oh, here we go. Yaron, can you hear us? All right. Well, why don't let's come back to the ADCs and we'll go with, it was a big week of deals. And Dawn and I are going to try to get through, these deals in somewhat rapid fashion because there's a lot of them. But the biggest one, well, first of all, we've got a Series A, a Series B, a Series C, but the mega deal rounds are definitely back. I know this has been talked about on prior biotech hangouts and why we're seeing these kind of large mega rounds come back. We're also seeing kind of a return of, the crossover space. We'll talk about that in a little bit in terms of the kind of active participation in, the more of the public equity funds. But Dawn, the biggest one is obviously the new obesity company, Hot Area, coming out of stealth with a high-profile CEO. You want to take on Metsera?
Sure. So this is a nice bit of reporting by Andrew Dunn at Endpoint. So he kind of pieced together in true investigative reporter fashion, various sources of information and sort of brought this company out of stealth, I think before it was ready to come out of stealth. This is called Metsera. It's a large, well-funded new venture led by Clyde Meanwell, who's founder and former CEO of the Medicines Company. And then shortly after selling to Novartis for almost $10 billion back in early 2020, he founded Population Health Partners, which is a VC focused on chronic prevalent diseases that he felt were being ignored at large by biotech VCs in favor of rare oncology and genetic diseases. And Metsera was incorporated back in 2022 and had been quietly amassing quite the pipeline of anti-obesity assets, mostly from Korean biotech D&D Pharmatech, but also through the acquisition of London-based biotech company ZHIP, or perhaps ZHIP, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, last year. And their pipeline now includes oral versions of GLP-1, a dual GLP-1 GIP agonist, a triple G therapy, and an amylin agonist, again, all oral therapies, and an injectable triple G that's slated for the clinic in the first half of next year. And ZHIP's website states that it has an exciting range of satiety hormone analogs in development that are optimized for maximum potency and extended half-lives, and combination treatments administered as a single injection also being developed. So that's quite the portfolio to come out of stealth with, even if it was maybe even earlier than they wanted to come out of stealth. So they have these assets, a $350 million war chest with Arch and Google and several other very high profile investors chipping in. And arguably this pipeline is as robust or more robust than some of our leaders, big pharma companies who are leading in the anti-obesity space and pursuing these same targets. So definitely one to watch, Chris.
Yeah. Any other comments from, all the analysts we have? We have Josh Schimmer, I forgot to mention up front, Paul Mateus, Yaron Werber and Dawn, who just spoke. Any just comments on just this size round for obesity? Again, I don't think we would have seen this a couple of years ago with this much interest in the obesity cardiometabolic space. Any other comments?
Well, I mean, your parent Clive Meanwell, who had a tremendous amount of success at Medicines Companies, kind of a brand name for investors, along with the hottest therapeutic category I think we've ever seen probably in our lifetime. So, not surprised that there's some big dollars being thrown around for that kind of a leadership and a company that's putting together multiple shots on goal.
Yeah, and Clive, obviously, years in the cardiovascular space, knows it well, and I think there was a lot of a signal of confidence there. We had another big PIPE reverse merger, Paragon Therapeutics, Fairmount Fund, and this one was called Aruka Therapeutics. Dawn, you want to start this one for us?
Sure. So the latest INI company from parent Paragon, as you mentioned, they're reverse mergering their way into the public markets by taking out Arca Biopharma. A Mike Bristow founded company which was looking to bring precision medicine to atrial fibrillation, but had failed their phase two trial back in 2018. The deal is expected to close in Q3. And the new ticker will be, I like this ticker, Orca, O-R-K-A. So they've secured a $275 million private investment. We'll get about $5 million in cash from ARCA, giving it runway through 27 to develop long-acting IL-23 and IL-17 assets for psoriasis and other skin diseases. And as we know, these are well-validated targets. There are multiple products on the market already from fierce competitors like AbbVie, J&J, UCB, Novartis. Those drugs tend to be administered four times a year, and Oruka is looking to differentiate themselves with once or twice yearly dosing. I think it's a tough space. I think that they can expect to have to, when they do come to market, negotiate some pretty deep discounts to get a favorable formulary status. And they hope to enter the clinic with both of these assets next year.
Yeah, and I'll just highlight, I mean, this has been one of the best trades over the last several years, especially during the down markets where, and credit to the Fairmount Fund guys and Paragon, you know, who founded Paragon Therapeutics, you know, Peter Harwin, Thomas Kiselak. You know, we actually collaborated with them on one of their first kind of ideas, which was a longer half-life for a plasma kallikrein antibody for hereditary angioedema. Now it's trading as Astria on the public markets. But, you know, they've done this repeatedly on the idea that they can create best-in-class that doesn't compromise any efficacy, maybe even a little better efficacy with better dosing intervals. And again, Apogee was a company they took directly public. That has been one of the best kind of publicly, traded companies over the last couple of years. So they found a very cool formula, and they found a lot of success. And their fund is really driving some of the better returns. The last quarter they were in the top tier. So in a short amount of time, they've been quite busy. And so I think that some of these pipes are driven on this past success and how this particular type of positioning is working well. So credit to all the folks behind this reverse merger of Oruka. Any other comments from any of you, Paul, Josh, Jerome, on this pipe?
I guess my impression is that the long-acting antibody technology from MedImmune's gone off patent, so now you're starting to see a lot of companies jump in and apply long-acting innovation to validated targets and antibodies. It'll be interesting to see how this all plays out. Obviously the appeal of less frequent injections, but there are competitive and IP dynamics at play here as well. So keeping an eye on the space.
Yep, for sure. And then I wanted to highlight a company that Bruce Booth joins this forum frequently, and this was an Atlas incubated founded company several years ago, and they participated in a Series C in Obsidian Therapeutics. And I think this is notable because this is the one I was mentioning that it really is a return of the crossover round. I think in a healthy IPO environment, this is probably a company that would have gone public directly, but they were able to announce they said significantly oversubscribed, which are some of the marketing terms you see in these PRs, but $175 million round. It was, definitely a syndicate that include Foresight Capital, Janus, Novo Holdings, RTW, T. Rowe. This is very indicative of what you would typically see in that type of crossover space. Surveyor Capital came in, a Citadel company. So I think that this is a signal that, those traditional public equity investors are, looking for those deals where, clinical stage, this is a company that the CEO, I know well, Madan Jagasia, joined as he was previously head of medical affairs at Iovance. Less than a year ago, he joined Obsidian as CEO. They announced clinical data in December with six patients. 50% had an overall response rate. A third of those had a complete response. And on the base of those six patients, to continue those studies. They're going to be presenting, I presume, more data at AACR. But this is a TIL therapy. It's an engineered TIL cell therapy that, as they describe it, it's a novel IL-2 sparing engineered TIL cell therapy armed with pharmacologically regulated membrane-bound IL-15 designed to enhance persistency, anti-tumor activity, and clinical safety of TIL cell therapy relative to unengineered TIL therapy plus high-dose IL-2. so that ability to kind of spare high-dose IL-2 is definitely a selling feature. Again, we'll look to that with anticipation, but again, a pretty high-profile Series C deal. There was a Series B that was also over $100 million called Altarome. Dawn, do you have a couple bullet points on this one?
Yeah, so that was led by Goldman Sachs Alternatives, along with several other investors and original Series A investors as well. They have two programs that they're looking to bring forward with this raise, AKT1 inhibitor and a KRAS inhibitor, which they hope to have both in the clinic next year. As you know, AZ has an approved pan-AKT inhibitor called TruCap for some breast cancer patients with the right genetic mutation, but Altarome is hoping that its candidate can be better tolerated by improving specificity of AKT inhibition. And in a similar vein, they're developing an isoform selective inhibitor of KRAS that targets 90% of KRAS mutations, including G12V and G12D. Currently approved KRAS inhibitors, Krazati and Lumakras, go after just the G12C mutation.
Flag Altarome's a San Diego-based company. Of course, gotta note that. Wonderful team. One of the investors in the financing was Dre House, who's really been very thoughtful about their investments in the targeted kinase inhibitor space in oncology. So just thought those were worth noting.
Excellent. So another deal that actually I was involved in directly, which was we launched a new co in the CNS space from a public company, Addex, that's Geneva-based. And like a lot of public companies, I mean, we've looked at dozens of public companies that could not fund all of the programs they had in their pipeline because of the market dynamics over the last few years. and, you know, it's hard to find really good assets, but we felt this group of, allosteric modulators out of Addex, and particularly one that is the most advanced is M4 PAM, which is the same class of drugs that Cerevel's schizophrenia drug falls into. And we felt that this one could be best in class. And obviously, Daphne's not here today, but, you know, Karuna's KarXT, which was an M1, M4 preferring muscarinic agonist, the schizophrenia field is definitely going to heat up. We think that this is a area that patients cycle through a lot of drugs, especially when, you know, you've got a lot of innovation in the space. So we were happy to fund that with a $63 million Series A to start this new co. And we'll be advancing the platform and other preclinical assets, but the lead program, we're excited about it for schizophrenia. And also in the schizophrenia news was the Teva Viatris, which is, you know, Mylan is now Viatris, but they challenged a patent to J&J's long-acting schizophrenia blockbuster called Invega Sustenna. And Invega has continued to, we talked about dosing intervals, continue to launch new products that extend out the dosing interval from once a month to once every 3 months to once every 6 months or once a year. And this Invega franchise is quite successful in the schizophrenia market. They generated over $4 billion worldwide, $2.9 billion in the U.S. just last year, even though this product was approved back in 2006. And so the generics were challenging it. They lost in New Jersey courts. J&J, as we all know, has a huge presence in New Jersey, but they lost in New Jersey. It went to a federal circuit appeals, and they sent it back and said, you didn't consider that the 906 patent, which is, you know, kind of a dosing patent for the Sustenna franchise, may be invalid. So it's going to go back to the New Jersey courts for consideration on that. And so, again, I think the stakes are high in schizophrenia, a lot of new entrants and a lot going on in that field. And then also in the CNS space, Dawn, you want to cover Contineum?
Yeah, I'll kick it off, and then I'd love to hear from others on the call about this. So this is Contineum announced on Monday that they were planning to go public, but yet last night they lowered their expected price range for the upcoming IPO to $16 a share, which is the lower end of the previously disclosed range. And then they cut the offering by almost 2 million shares. And so now they expect to raise about 110 million from the IPO, down from 136 million at the beginning of the week. They plan to use the funds to advance their phase two asset, which is a selective inhibitor of MR1 in multiple sclerosis. They partnered this asset with J&J, who plans to begin a phase two trial in depression with this asset later this year. They were incubated in Versant's Inception Sciences unit. I believe that's also out in San Diego, Josh, if I'm not mistaken. And after selling off a piece of the company that had been focused on regenerative therapies for MS to Roche back in 2018, they carried on and spun out this new co, which originally was called Pipeline Therapeutics and then rebranded to Contineum late last year. In addition to the MS asset, they are also planning a phase 1B trial of their LPA1R antagonist for both interstitial pulmonary fibrosis and progressive MS. They claim to be the only company in the clinic with a brain-penetrant LPA1R antagonist for MS, and they are also in preclinical stages with a peripherally restricted LPA1R antagonist, presumably for the IPF indication and others. Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Stifel, and RBC Capital Markets were joint bookrunners for the IPO.
Yeah, let me ask, as we've just heard about a bunch of deals, there's clearly a lot of dry powder on the sidelines, people searching for good deals, willing to put, big money into these. But this IPO, kind of pulling back, I don't know that there's a lot of companies right now active in the queue. Part of that might be the timing of, kind of the calendar for earnings. But yeah, just some thoughts about, this IPO market and the ability for companies to go public. Josh, Paul, Yaron, any comments on this?
I think we're watching each one closely to gauge the risk appetite of the market for subsequent IPOs. I'd argue, I'm not as close to the story. And Dawn, you're right, they are San Diego based, wonderful CEO, and group there. My perception, though, is this one is maybe a little bit higher on the risk spectrum, and if this goes well for Contineum, that may open the floodgates of a number of other companies across the risk spectrum who are waiting for a clearer signal of the IPO market opening up. There's a lot of good private companies out there, I think, that are waiting to queue up. We've had a fairly prolonged period where the IPO window hasn't been entirely shut, but fairly tight, which means we've had a lot of private companies maturing, reaching the important milestones and catalysts in ways that they otherwise wouldn't have in a wide open IPO market. And that just, I think, ultimately sets up for a more healthy IPO class of 2024 and hopefully beyond.
Yeah, Paul, you're on. Any comments on what you guys have in sentiment for IPO for the next 6 to 9 months of 2024?
Yeah, I would say it's your own. So I would say we do a sentimeter survey every quarter. And for the first time, I would say in probably 3 years, interest in IPOs is continuing to increase, which is great to see. And, we're very much into thematic investments now. It's sort of kind of the pulse of the buy side. And so what they're really, the companies that are more promising are the ones that have some data or late stage or just doing fast followers. And those are probably going to be the initial tranche, just like Josh is saying. It's interesting about Contineum, just given the risk profile. So it's kind of interesting that they've cut it back a little bit. But we're seeing a lot of much better quality now than we did probably in the last year, year and a half of the last bull run. And I think it's going to be a healthy class. A lot of companies are getting teed up for the end of the year. And if things kind of improve, they might even pull it forward into Q3. Yeah. But we'll need
That's
to see.
Great. Paul, any comments?
Yeah, I can't comment at all on this IPO, but just on the broader market sentiment, I mean, I think we've all talked on this podcast and others even more regularly than me, right, that it's improved a lot. But I do think there's still a little bit of, PTSD from 2020, 2021, right? Like you look at the XBI and we got to 100 and then there's been a pullback to 90. And, I think... I think just broadly speaking, again, just to, as I think about the questions I get in stocks in my universe and earlier stage companies, sentiment is good in biotech. There's capital that's on the sidelines. People are willing to take on risk. But I think there's also just a lot of hope broadly that biotech doesn't get ahead of itself again. And, you know, that might explain some trepidation generally.
Yep. Yaron, we're going to come to you in a minute on ADCs, but we also had some on the negative news side. I want to cover Amylyx and Acorda. Josh and Paul, if you guys can handle that. Josh, maybe you go first on Amylyx.
Yeah, so probably the biggest surprise of the unfortunate Amylyx saga after the Relvario trial for ALS failed wasn't surprising because there was really no neurofilament signal. Biggest surprise is how quickly they're moving to pull the drug from the market. And really, kudos to the company for doing the right thing. I think what's particularly interesting here is you could envision perhaps a lens of the fiduciary duty to investors to keep the product around as long as they can, try to drive as much revenue and profitability out of it before it gets forced off the market, in contrast to the duty to the patient and medical community to kind of, quote, do the right thing. I think in biotech, you often see those forces at odds. But really, the most important thing for the sector is to always do what's right for the patients and the medical community first. And, you know, even if that it sometimes goes against what the fiduciary duty obligation might be. So really, again, kudos to the Amylyx team for doing the right thing after that failed trial. Paul, curious your thoughts on it.
Yeah, thanks, Josh. I mean, I think the angle why I wanted to comment on this is that there's an interesting conversation here related to this drug and what it means for accelerated approval in just neuroscience in general. Obviously, the FDA, you know, went out a limb on approving this drug after there were two advisory committee meetings, and their own internal statistical review was a lot more critical. But I agree with you. I mean, I think what the team has done there is a huge favor to the industry, because by, you know, moving quickly and pulling this drug, I think the conclusion on the regulatory side is going to be that, hey, like, the accelerated approval pathway worked here, right? We gave something a try. The data were promising. The safety was good enough that the risk benefit was favorable. And then, you know, look, it's certainly disappointing, right? But I honestly feel like this is good and kind of continues to sort of support the tailwinds in the space for the FDA being more flexible in neuroscience and more open to lots of different kinds of things like biomarkers, et cetera.
Yeah, and I'll just say, you know, this is the team that actually signaled before the drug was approved that if the, you know, confirmatory study didn't read out, that they would. So one, I think they retained their credibility, right, by following through what they said they were going to do. But I think importantly for our industry, this idea of, hey, we are, you know, mature enough to self-police, and we're going to do the right thing, rather than playing this game of chicken with the FDA of being, you know, forced to pull it off and all of that. I think the more we can signal that as an industry, we can make the hard decisions and not wait for the FDA to police these things, I think that's going to allow us a little bit more, you know, flexibility in the future. You know, another one, which is, you know, Acorda, which filed for bankruptcy. I mean, I think we all know Ron Cohen has been a fixture in our industry for decades. He's almost been the Energizer Bunny in terms of how Acorda has just continued to move forward and survive, but it's come to its end of its road. And so, Josh, you want to start that one, and we'll go to Paul as well.
Yeah, it's been quite the ride for Acorda from their 2006 IPO. Ron Cohen as the CEO from start to finish. They got approval of Ampyra in 2010 and reached $450 million in sales in 2018, and then went generic. They had another drug approved, Imbrija for Parkinson's, but that was really never able to gain traction. There are a couple of acquisitions along the way. The deal for Imbrija cost around $550 million or so. There's another transaction for Biote for around $350 million, and that trial failed. So it's been a bit of a roller coaster and a struggle for Acorda, and unfortunate to kind of see them go at this point in filing for bankruptcy. And they finished the fourth quarter with $30 million in cash, $186 million in convertible notes, and just didn't seem like they were able to generate any of the cash flow that they had suggested they'd be able to. So a long and interesting saga at the end of the road.
Paul, any thoughts?
Yeah, not a ton to add. I mean, I do think that, you know, again, from the perspective of Acordis plight, you know, right or wrong, in Brija, I think actually not getting much traction has made it harder for other companies in the Parkinson space to get a lot of attention from investors, right? I mean, I remember Cerevel with, you know, where their lead drug in their mind originally was tavapadon, and I think the street thought, no, it's the muscarinic because Parkinson's is so challenging. So it's unfortunate. Ron's obviously a great guy and accomplished a lot. It'll be interesting to see if he turns up anywhere.
Yeah, it's surprising how many companies have gone down commercially around the Parkinson's space, right? You had Adamas that you know, they had some decent traction with their program. Neurocrine with Ongentys just really never got off.
I mean, they gave that drug away. It's kind of unbelievable, right?
Yeah, it always felt like there's a significant unmet need in Parkinson's, and yet for some reason just hard to get traction with more incremental therapies. Obviously, anything with transformational outcomes likely to do quite well. But I think we're still waiting for those. I know Denali and Biogen have a really interesting shot on goal with their LRRK2 inhibitor.
Yeah, which is harder in the CNS space, right? I mean, it's, you know, I think this is why the comments about schizophrenia, we talked about, you know, MS, you know, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's. I mean, it's great that there's so much interest to try to unlock those, you know, blockbusters. But another bankruptcy this week, Eiger, in a similar kind of tangent, you know, they refocused on a GLP-1 agonist for rare complication of gastric bypass surgery. So even having a GLP-1 in this environment wasn't enough to attract interest. They they had a phase 3 study in hepatitis D virus that failed. But this is another company that struggled over years and years. So I just want to highlight that, you know, all is not out of the woods for a lot of these companies in this environment. I think we're going to continue to see companies struggle to get funding to that may have to close down, might have to see more bankruptcies. So we're kind of in this transitional stage. As it seems. So let's go now to Yaron. I know we couldn't hear you originally, but hopefully you can talk about a big deal of the week in the ADC space and some other news in the ADC. Why don't you take that one?
Yeah, so ADCs are continuing to be, you know, unbelievably sort of in vogue. I mean, just in our coverage universe, we have Beijing, we have BioNTech, we have Alexis Exposed. I mean, it just keeps coming. Obviously, Genmab was already there. And now this week they announced that they bought Profound Bio, which was a private company originally out of China, sort of Chinese US company with a really promising ADC technology. They bought it for $1.8 billion, so that's not a small amount at all, into a fairly competitive, this is the folate receptor alpha space. Recall, this is where AbbVie bought Immunogen, you know, for several billion. This is the drug they bought is called Rina-S. It's in phase 1/2. The differentiation here is it's hydrophilic, so it's going to have better potential sort of penetration. It's also TOPO1. It does have a drug-to-antibody ratio of 8, so it's essentially double the competition. So hopefully it's supposed to be more potent. So what does the data show? Well, we have 21 patients worth of data. On an ITT basis, it's 38, so it's sort of, you know, fairly similar. But when you look at patients that have more than a 1% expression, it's 67%, so much higher than Elahere, which is that drug from Immunogen. They're going to have more data in the second half of this year. They obviously saw a lot more than what we also sort of at SITC late last year, and they'll move into next year into phase 3. The key differentiation, frankly, is no ILD, no pneumonitis, and no corneal tox. Elahere has a black box for ocular toxin warning for pneumonitis, and they do have 3 other drugs, by the way. The other company, by the way, in the space is Sutro. They have Luvelta, which is a DAR4. That's in phase 2/3, so they are ahead. Response rates seems more or less similar to what we're seeing now from Genmab and Profound. Sutro also has a better profile tox-wise than Elahere, but this drug does have a little bit of neutropenia and peripheral neuropathy. So this is going to definitely be a fairly crowded space long-term. But it looks like, again, the first company will get trumped or you get kind of passed over time. And then two other deals. So we mentioned Sutro. Well, they also sold their preclinical asset. This is ROR1 ADC. It's the Sutro-003. They sold that to Ipsen. So Ipsen is now moving into ADCs. $90 million upfront between an upfront and equity. $900 sort of bio dollars all in. And this is going to be, this is an extra TCAN payload. So we'll have to see how the differentiation is going to be. Obviously, Sutro knows what they're doing in the ADC space. And this is focused on solid and heme malignancies. And then finally, Merck KGaA, which, as you recall, originally went into ADCs with Mersana in 2022 with the STING agonist. And then they followed it up in October of last year with a deal with Hengrui out of China, $169 million upfront. That was for a Claudin 18.2 ADC. Claudin 18.2 is validated with Astellas now. That was the old BioNTech team, but that's a naked antibody. So this is an ADC. And now this week they announced a $1.4 billion deal for ADC technologies with the AI company Caris Discovery for 15 targets. So obviously that's very early, but lots going on in the space. I mean, this is, Zymeworks is worth following, moving very aggressively into ADCs. There's going to be a lot going on.
Yeah, I know we've talked about this ADC theme on a few of the biotech hangouts in recent weeks. Anything to add, Josh or Paul, in terms of this sector and what you're seeing?
Yeah, I know you start to wonder at what point there's a little bit of an ADC bubble. But I think there are more ADC programs in development than there are solid tumors to think about treating. And ultimately, when a patient develops resistance to the payload of one ADC, they're unlikely to respond to another with a similar payload. So it's still early, I think, for the leaders in this field. There's still clearly plenty of opportunity, but for those who are just kind of now embarking on ADC innovation, they're really going to have to bring something special to the game that'll help them differentiate in what's looking like an increasingly crowded field.
Great. All right. Well, Yaron, there another big news event was Roivant in a couple of ways, actually. If you want to cover what's going on with Roivant.
Yeah, so Roivant, had a great week. I think the stock kind of performed a little bit, but kind of almost three sets of big news going on. First one is brepocitinib, which is their TYK2 JAK1. We've had Matt Glein on the show before, and we talked about this. That drug is in phase 3 for dermatomyositis. We really like that one based on the biology, the broad mechanism of action. There's more than 1,500 patients worth of data, and the profile is very acceptable. And they'll finish enrollment to the phase 3 with DM in Q3. So we'll probably have data sometime Q4 next year, sort of on track. But the news this week was non-infectious uveitis, NIU. A lot of Wall Street was kind of like, what is this indication? Is this a real indication? Like, how many patients are there? So it's not competitive. Only Humira is approved. We think the market opportunity right now, there's more than 30,000 patients getting treated. We think it can go up to 70,000. So definitely an interesting market. And their data looked really, really good. Their treatment failure was only 29% at 24 weeks. Dose response, there was no placebo, but a nice dose response. Just to comp it for everybody, Humira in their study had a 62% treatment failure at 25 weeks. Three things really, really interesting. One, the steroid tapering was a lot faster in the brepocitinib study versus Humira. So it's pretty, respectable and impressive data, especially given how fast patients tapered off. It's also the amount of time they were off steroids before they measured the endpoint was impressive. And then they had definitively better outcomes than Humira. And they had essentially no macular edema. Humira has 15%. So the data looked really, really good. They'll now move into phase 3 in the second half of the year. So concomitantly, they have a lot of cash. So they announced essentially a $1.5 billion buyback. The big part of that is they're buying the entire Sumitomo stake at a big discount. It was almost like a 15% roughly discount to the stock price. They bought 648 million, so the entire Sumitomo stake down. And there's about 850 million left, which they presumably will do open market buyers, or they'll maybe continue to buy down, the SoftBank stake. And then finally, you know, it's probably close to a lot of people's heart is that battle between Arbutus and Roivant against Moderna for the COVID royalties. So the Markman hearing happened about a month ago, and the judge rendered a decision. And as many, you know, people expected who were following this, there were four specific, three patents at stake, essentially four claims. And essentially, it was a nice clean win for Roivant Arbutus. They won sort of three out of the four claims. You know, later on this year, Moderna is probably going to try to throw it out as a summary judgment, arguing that this is, they really sold it to the U.S. government, all these vaccines, and it's a U.S. government issue. The judge is going to render an opinion. We think he's probably reject that. And then they'll go to court in April of next year. We think there's a very high likelihood they're going to win. And then, of course, 6 months behind is the litigation with Pfizer. Pfizer, interestingly, is not making the claim that the drug was sold to the U.S. government, and so that they're not going to have a sort of any liability. That Markman hearing is a little bit behind. The patents are somewhat overlapping, but somewhat different. But at the end of the day, we think Roivant's going to end up being with Arbutus in a very good position, and they'll probably get remunerated. The question is going to be sort of when, is there going to be a settlement and things like that.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to watch what these settlements, if you know, that are publicly announced or judgments will be with, you know, just how much money was made off of, you know, the COVID vaccines and yet where the market is today. It'll be interesting how that's all calculated and what's, you know, kind of fair in a settlement. But yeah, a lot going on at Roivant.
So Chris, so there was $100 billion in sales just retrospectively, yeah. Right, before this year. A new royalty rate, now, of course, a new means there's a lot of risk. You don't know if it's ever going to come to fruition, is 6 to 14% for the LNP technology. Yeah. And in these cases, you can argue for treble damages, you know, but yeah, they're going to settle. But the question is, how big of a check is it going to be?
That'll be interesting to watch. Josh, I want to go to Gritstone. You know, this neoantigen cancer vaccine, it's been a tough kind of area and, you know, long history. And, you know, you want to cover this Gritstone phase two announcement?
Yeah. So the stock was cut in half on their phase two. Interesting setup here. This is one of those trials that takes a more experimental therapy, pairs it with checkpoint inhibitors, and then compares that against like standard chemotherapy. So you're not really sure what you're testing, but at least they did a controlled trial. And also kudos to them for focusing on ctDNA as, you know, an early and robust measure of treatment effect. Now, they didn't see a meaningful separation early in ctDNA, and sounds like they were surprised by the depth and durability of the response, the molecular response in the treatment control arm, which, you know, it to be determined what comes next for Gritstone. What I think is so interesting and relevant about this is that, you know, oncology drug development for years, for decades, been guided by RECIST responses and to some extent PFS and overall survival. And it really has not been a good, robust biomarker to guide treatment decisions. And to see the ctDNA response of the kind of chemo induction control arm be more significant than they had expected is a good reminder that, you know, that the whole chemo industry evolved with really no great biomarker to guide dosing intensity, dosing interval, and the world may have looked quite different if we'd had these tools and they had been used earlier on. Still quite surprised that we don't see more companies leveraging ctDNA in the way that Gritstone did. I thought it was a great decision to get probably one of the cleanest early reads on and least noisy early reads on efficacy, but unfortunate to see that didn't quite play out the way that they were hoping.
Yeah, I have a history with Andrew Allen. When I was at Celgene, led the acquisition for Pharmion, where he was the chief medical officer. And one of the main reasons we decided to go after it is we thought he was one of the most thoughtful kind of clinical developers and really predicted the positive data on, you know, this competitive HDAC inhibitor at the time. And so really saw him always as a really good clinical trialist. And so it was just interesting to see him, you know, talk about clinical trial and some of the choices that were made and in retrospect, because, you know, he's somebody who always is very thoughtful going into these clinical trials. But yeah, again, this has been a controversial area with these cancer vaccines. So, you know, I think, but it's been surviving, right, as a modality that people will continue to study and have hope for. Let's go to Paul and Verve Therapeutics. This, you know, created a lot of buzz, especially on Bio Twitter. Yeah, if you can help us with that one. And then Kostas is a analyst from BMO who is going to join us. So Kostas, I ask you to raise your hand if you want to come in and comment on Verve. But Paul, why don't you kick this off for us?
Okay, sweet. Well, I look forward to what Kostas has to say and maybe how he reacts to sort of my comment and how I see the broader sort of like offshoot debate here. But Verve paused the test of their gene editor for HeFH after a patient experienced elevated liver enzymes and low platelet levels. They're advancing a backup that leverages a different LNP. And I think implicit in that, right, is a framework in their view that this is driven by the LNP and not the actual editor itself or the target itself. There shouldn't be related to the target, I wouldn't think. I mean, I think the broader conversation here is as sort of I see it, and I don't formally cover Verve stock, but I, you know, follow a number of companies in the genetic medicine space. It's just, you know, what's the right indication from a proof of concept perspective and from a commercial perspective? And if you look at, you know, where a lot of gene therapies or where a lot of oligonucleotide-based therapies first found their footing, you know, they tended to be in diseases where there were no therapeutic alternatives or very, very poor therapeutic alternatives, right? You know, I think about SMA, TTR amyloidosis, DMD, you know, gene therapy for also for SMA. And we could talk about that too. So without listing it all, and, you know, obviously in Verve, the broader debate in the investor community has sort of been, is this the right place for this technology, given that these other patients do have options? And, you know, does that create a dynamic from a development perspective where just the safety hurdle is super, super high? And so, you know, hindsight's 2020, but, you know, when I just kind of think about from my coverage of Alnylam, you know, it took them a very long time to get to a place where we were really ready for RNAi for high cholesterol. And so, yeah, I don't know. I think that's sort of just one perspective that becomes more salient here. What do you think, Kostas?
Thank you, Paul. That's very helpful. And Kostas Biliouris here from BMO Capital Markets. I largely agree with you. And actually, this is a reason that this adverse event that Verve observed here, which was high AST levels and thrombocytopenia, although it could have been acceptable in a different setting here, given the alternative treatment options that patients have, is probably very challenging to move forward with this drug. That's why Verve decided to pause this compound for now and move on with the alternative, which uses a different LNP and has potentially a broader therapeutic window that will have an improved safety. One interesting takeaway here, I would say, is that these new patients that were treated, four patients, did not experience any heart attack, unlike the previous nine patients. So this lowers the risk to some extent that the treatment has caused heart attacks in the previous outcome. So what we are watching moving forward is whether the new LNP that Verve is using will cause these kind of adverse events and what implications these adverse events have for other companies. For example, Beam, which is also using base editing and an LNP from Acuitas, similar to Verve, is going to evaluate its treatment in alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. And we are watching, although there are differences in the LNPs, we try to understand what could be the potential implications there. But overall, this was something that, again, may have been acceptable in other indications, but here is challenging to accept.
Yeah, I mean, this is interesting. I did listen to, you know, Brad Loncar, who's a co-moderator on this forum, you know, week in and week out. He interviewed Sek, the CEO of Verve, and Sek made a clear case on, you know, how they have data to suggest that it's clearly the LNP and nothing else. But when you see situations like this, oftentimes it's, you know, it does create an overhang of, you know, bringing in a, you know, a new LNP, you know, a delivery. I think, you know, where people, if you don't have any bad news, you're going to be given more of the benefit of the doubt. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, how cautious investors are going to be or industry to accept, you know, the new one. And will, you know, good preclinical data be enough to, you know, convince folks? How many patients are they going to need to see treated? But yeah, I think, you know, Paul, you said it well, which is the Alnylam example, I think is a good one of, you know, sometimes it takes some time to work through these issues. Yeah, we just, you know, this is biotech, right? We always hit bumps in the road along the way that are unforeseen. Any other comments on the Verve story from your own Josh, Dawn, anybody? Okay. All right, let's move on. There, like I said, there's a lot of data readouts, a lot of deals this week. We have Lens Therapeutics. Josh, if you want to cover this phase three study for presbyopia.
Yeah, so this is the company that reverse merged into Graphite. It's another San Diego-based company. And their drops, acyclidine drops for presbyopia, for those of us who are at the age that we need reading glasses and who might prefer drops instead. This is a muscarinic agonist. Now, AbbVie had launched a drug into this market a few years back, and it started off really well, but then it turned into a commercial flop. Because I think some of the concerns were that the AbbVie's Vuity was working well, but it was just wearing off way too early, and there were some issues with patients experiencing headaches, and just net didn't really gain much traction. So Lens is back at it with this approach. It looks like it's getting much longer lasting treatment effect. So a positive phase three data readout. Planning to file for approval in mid-2024, and I'm hoping at some point to get some samples and figure out how well they work, not just for reading, because I'm one of those folks getting to the age where I need to hold my phone kind of away from me to read the letters, which is kind of annoying. And then if you ever have like glare at night around lights when you're driving, you know, like those can be really disruptive. And so a therapy like this could also be helpful for that. So interested to see how this one evolves and whether they can succeed in ways that that AbbVie's Vuity was not able to. Sounds like there's a lot of interest from the community in this product.
Yeah, and I like that we're seeing just broader efforts in the ophthalmology kind of eye disease space where, you know, we've seen some big deals. We've seen a lot of, you know, investment interest, and this will be one that is interesting to watch how it evolves. So Paul, Vertex also, they have a phase three kidney disease trial that read out. So you want to talk about that one?
Yeah, sure. So this was actually this precursor to ultimately the pivotal study. So the backstory here is their drug VX-147 inexaplin is an APOL1 inhibitor, and they're pursuing it for APOL1 mediated kidney disease. They had some really interesting, I guess, phase 2A data in one APOL1 mediated population where they showed a pretty nice reduction in various biomarkers, and they went forward. The interesting nuance here is that in the pivotal study, they're going to a much, much broader population of patients who have APOL1 mutations. And if you look at these different kidney population subsets, there's one paper that shows that the odds ratio for these mutations in some groups is, you know, up to 17x, whereas in others, it's as low as 3x. And so, you know, I think the question with this asset has been, you know, will it work in the kind of more enriched patients as well as the less enriched patients? Is that even the right way to ask this question, or is there a common kind of biology? But, you know, this interim analysis is something that they were never really going to show much data from. So I think the underlying assumption is that they've been able to replicate some of that initial biomarker data. But the broader debate on the street is now they go into a more heterogeneous population. And certainly how broadly this works will dictate whether or not it is a big revenue driver for Vertex, given the size of CF and, you know, the hype around pain.
Yeah, that's great. And again, this theme of accelerated approval will be interesting to watch. I can't remember the company, but the company ended up shutting down programs of which they received three breakthrough designations from the FDA. And so, again, some of this highlighting of like what, you know, constitutes that breakthrough if many of them fail. I know the FDA used to give statistics around that. And so it'll be interesting to watch how, you know, accelerated approval continues to evolve from the FDA eyes. But let's go to, you know, Dawn, I know we've covered this topic a lot on this forum, but it just continues to be in the headlines. You want to talk about the latest on the whole BioSecure Act and what's going on with China suppliers and U.S. biotech?
Yeah, so this week, the architects of the House version of the BioSecure Act, Mike Gallagher and Krishnamurthy, petitioned the White House to add seven more Chinese biotechs to the list of companies suspected of working with Beijing's military. Inomics, Stomics, Origin Cell, Vazyme, Biotech, and others are put on the list with the concern that China could create synthetic pathogens to use as biological weapons, God forbid. So it continues to be a beating of the drum around this risk to national security from some Chinese biotechs. I think it's really interesting this week. John Crowley, the new head of bio, has gone on the record in two forums, and we'll post those for listeners. So there was a great interview with BioCentury. Ahead of the paywall. It's on YouTube on their BioCentury show YouTube channel. Bruce Booth was interviewed there a couple weeks back by Simone. And he went on the record, I think, on this issue in a really helpful way. And, you certainly can listen to it if you're very interested in the legislative sausage making. But I think a few points that were raised that are worth repeating is that there is a lot of confusion, certainly in the biotech community, but also on the Hill, about what this bill is and isn't and the impact that it could have on the industry. It is unlikely to pass as standalone legislation, and that's, again, the legislative sausage-making about how it's being brought forth and who's bringing it forward, but it is possible that some version could get appended to an appropriations bill, to a defense appropriations bill, which, if passed, would be sometime in the second half of this year or toward the end of the year. And so John stated that he felt that it gives time for bio and others to shape the legislation and make sure that it first does no harm, and that those principles of national security are in place, but also that the principle of preserving the United States' robust biotech ecosystem within the context of a global supply chain, is maintained. So there's a lot of rhetoric and hyperbole out there. There's certainly some risk, but there, in my opinion, it's just my opinion, no need to panic. I think this is in a lot of ways raises great points with Congress of the need to invest in the United States for biotech resources, especially manufacturing, because the global supply chain, as we saw during COVID, at the time I was managing operations for Novartis Canada, and we were on the phone with Health Canada every other week with supply shortages from our Sandoz, generics company. So the global supply chain challenges are real, and we need to do what we can to make sure Congress understands how we can secure the U.S. business and not impede it in any way through ill-informed legislation like this. But he also wrote an op-ed piece on STAT, so I'll post both of those links if other people are interested in looking further into it.
Great. Yeah. And Dawn, I'm in a few different forums where, we are getting, line of sight into what's going on the legislative side. And, all of the policy experts that I've interacted with, there's a couple of things. One, there was the term genetic harvesting that was bandied about. And I've also heard now that there's actually concern, maybe more concern about IP sharing with the Chinese national government. But what I'm hearing pretty consistently is that, and this is also, co-authors of the bill, Jake Auchincloss, who's a kind of a friend of industry, knows our industry very well. He's on the Democratic side. He also co-wrote the TikTok bill. All the intelligence suggests that, hey, there really are real, threats here and real concerns. And I've heard that although I don't think this has been publicly shared, but I have heard that there are efforts to talk to U.S. Firms and U.S. investors who could potentially provide a solution. Now, you're right. The panic issue is that, you know, it's a long time before we even know. There's also the biggest thing is the talk of a grandfathering in. And so I think that's the biggest legislative effort of if companies are already working with Chinese vendors, will there be a grandfathering in? But, you know, again, I think this isn't going to go away quickly is what I'm hearing, you know, from, you know, my intelligence sources who are close to Washington. But it'll be interesting to watch. I think every company's making their own choices about how much risk they're willing to take and how much they take this seriously. Well, look, we covered a lot. Thank you all for tuning in. I'm going to go to each of our co-hosts and ask for some final comments on any of the themes we talked about here or any shout outs of any news items we didn't talk about. Dawn Suander, why don't we start with you and then we'll go to Yaron, Paul, and close out with Josh.
Sure. I think you said me first. I just am really excited to see all of the financings we had this week, including a continuing, perhaps not, you know, not as robust IPO market as we like to see, but a consistent IPO market continuing to come forward. It feels very optimistic to me and like we're making progress in the industry.
Great. Yaron, any thoughts on this week's news?
Yeah, I mean, for all of us biotechies, I mean, this is going to be a barrage of data, great data, and a lot of medical meetings to go to. I mean, it's going to be ATS to EASL to EAACI to multiple meetings on top of ASCO to EHA to ADA. I mean, it's just like endless to EULAR. There's going to be a lot of data coming from the sector, so we're very excited.
Yeah, 'tis the season for sure. So, Paul, comments.
Yeah, quickly, the stuff we're looking at near term is some data coming over the weekend for olezarsen from Ionis, which is important as they kind of solidify with their next-gen LICA platform that the safety profile of their drugs is vastly improved over first-gen, as well as data from Alnylam's hypertension medication, zilebesiran, which is now partnered with Roche. And, you know, the main focus there is how does the safety look combined with standard of care, but so far so good.
Great. And Josh, you want to close us out with final comments?
Yeah. I mean, look, the XBI is right back to where it started at the beginning of the year after a little rally. It's still up, you know, 20% year over year. Makes it an interesting setup. There are probably still some pockets of frothiness, but also some great opportunities out there. So always on the hunt for them.
Great. Well, again, thanks everybody for tuning in. If you want more information about our hosts or guest speakers or to listen to the most recent episode, you can always go to biotechhangout.com. So look forward to all of you tuning in next Friday as well at noon Eastern time. And thank you for joining. We'll close it out now.